May it please the court.
It does.
Simply stated, the appellate court got it right when it reversed the Labor and Industrial Relations Commission in the four cases before you today. The commission was incorrect in holding that the statutory thresholds in the third sentence of Section 287.220.1 can be met by converting multiple disabilities to weeks, lumping them together regardless of whether they are for the body as a whole or for a major extremity, and then comparing the resulting number of weeks to the 50-week body as a whole threshold. In this era of strict construction of the workers' compensation law, it is unclear what prompted the commission to suddenly reverse course and expand the second injury fund's liability in December 2011 after 18 years of applying the statutory threshold for fund liability in Section 287.220.1. These thresholds, first implemented in 1993, have been interpreted historically by the administrative law judges, the commission, and the appellate court to apply on an individual basis to every single disability, pre-existing or subsequent, for which compensability is sought from the fund.
Well, there have been cases which have said that multiple disabilities to the same extremity can all be considered together. Isn't that right?
There is one case, Ship versus Treasurer, which says that in that case, under those very specific circumstances, it was appropriate for the administrative law judge to rate injuries, multiple injuries to the claimant's arm, as a single injury to the shoulder. Yes, Judge.
And do you agree or disagree with that?
I don't think that the facts in this case are conducive to a SHIP analysis. If you look at the arm, a major extremity, whether it's the arm or the legs, and you look at the schedule of losses, what happens as you go up is each level as you go higher necessarily includes the level below. So I'm standing here pointing to my arm, but you have the 175-week level is at your wrist. You have 200, 210, 222, 232. And so let's say if you lose your arm as a whole, well, then you've necessarily lost everything from your shoulder down. And so to that end, it makes some sense under the right facts or circumstances.
So I was going to ask a question. If you can add those together, why not body as a whole? But perhaps you're answering it with that. What would that reasoning apply?
I'm headed that direction, definitely. So the way that the major extremities go, as you go up, the level increases. With the body as a whole, you don't have that necessary relationship between the different injuries. Mr. Whitty's case is, I think, a great example of that. In this instance, he has one of his disabilities, for example, was lazy eye, but then another one is diabetes. And there's simply no relationship there the way that there is with if I lose my arm, my wrist goes with it, or if I have a shoulder injury, it necessarily impacts the use of the rest of my arm.
Judge Pfeiffer says in his dissent that, or his concurring in part and dissenting in part, that he thinks you should add together the body as a whole injuries because the statute talks about the disability, and the disability is to the body as a whole. Can you respond to that?
Sure. The disabilities at issue in Mr. Whitty's case are very distinct. It's not like a case where you have a doctor who says, this man has diabetes, and therefore he has other problems related to that disability. In this case, we have one of the disabilities, for example, is a spastic colon. Another one is depression. It doesn't flow necessarily that if you have one of those that it affects the other and vice versa. And there simply is no medical testimony or any other testimony in this case that there's any sort of relationship among Mr. Whitty's disparate disabilities.
Thank you. Is there any kind of scientific basis? Like, you just went through the arm. This is 175. This is 222. This is 232. Is there any scientific basis for any of that?
It certainly does seem arbitrary, and I don't know that I'd want to give up any of my parts for any of that, frankly. But it's based on things like actuarial studies, insurance premiums, those sorts of things. So I would say it is based in science, but, you know, how well those raw numbers translate to real life is a real struggle, frankly, in this practice.
Thank you very much.
As used in Section 287.220, the phrase a disability and the disability refer to a single disability and not multiple disabilities combined. Each individual disability is then compared to its applicable threshold. A disability of the body as a whole must equal a minimum of 50 weeks of compensation. A disability to a major extremity must equal a minimum of 15% partial disability. In this case, Part of what baffled us when these decisions came down was the commission's statement that no support exists in the statutes or case law to interpret the statute in the manner in which it's always been interpreted. The commission neither acknowledged the existence of that authority nor tried to distinguish it, but it is, in fact, indistinguishable. If you look at what the commission said, its entire methodology was flawed from its premise. For example, if you look at page 5 of the award in this case, the commission stated, quote, in the incident case, employee had more than a single pre-existing disabling condition, so the first threshold, i.e. the body as a whole, applies. Then the commission went on to say, we must determine if employee's overall pre-existing permanent partial disability stated in weeks meets or exceeds 50 weeks. In contrast to the commission's new methodology, however, in order to calculate fund liability correctly, you do not apply the body as a whole threshold for non-body as a whole disabilities. You do not lump disabilities together to see if, when combined, they meet or exceed the threshold. And you do not ignore the thresholds for ensuing disabilities merely because one disability qualifies. And I don't want to steal my colleague's thunder, but the case Salvicio from the Eastern District has a great footnote about that. In order to analyze the second injury fund's liability, you must look very carefully at the third sentence in section 287.220.1. And if you look at that sentence, there are many, many elements that a claimant must establish in order to qualify for fund liability. The individual must be an employee, must have a pre-existing permanent partial disability, and it must be of such seriousness to constitute a hindrance or obstacle to employment or to obtaining re-employment if the employee becomes unemployed. That pre-existing permanent partial disability must, if a body as a whole injury, equal a minimum of 50 weeks of compensation, or if a major extremity injury only, must equal a minimum of 15% permanent partial disability. In addition, once you meet that threshold and all of those prerequisites for the pre-existing injuries, then you start the analysis anew with the subsequent compensable injury. And you look at whether that results in permanent partial disability. And again, you go back to those same numerical thresholds. You go back to 50 weeks compensation for the body as a whole injury, and you go back to the 15% for a major extremity. Then you look at whether the combination of those two injuries, the pre-existing and the subsequent, caused by the combined disabilities is substantially greater than that which would result from the last injury alone. Then, if you have all of those things, and if the employee is entitled to receive compensation, then you go on to the fourth sentence. So after you navigate what one of the decisions called the statutory thicket of the 212-word third sentence, then you move on to the calculation in the fourth sentence. In order to qualify for fund benefits, an employee has to meet every single element of this section, this third sentence in that section. And if you don't have one of those elements, you don't qualify. So when you get down to the fourth sentence and you're talking about all disabilities in existence, what the commission said was, after the third sentence, that's where the service of the threshold ends. Really, to some extent, that is true, because once you go through that third sentence, you have what I like to analogize it to, a card game. You have your hand that you're dealt. You go through. You think about the rules of the game. These are the ones I keep. These are the ones I discard. I discard those. I forget about those. I pick up what I have, and I see whether I win or lose. To me, it's a lot like that. You go through the third sentence. You have your discard pile, your keep pile, and then when you get to the fourth sentence, then you look at those. You don't go back and say, well, I really wanted that one, or I wish I had that one back. That's not how it works. The commission said once you get to the fourth sentence, everything comes back in. But that's not true. If you have something that's not a hindrance or obstacle in the third sentence, you don't get to bring it back in. And it's no different for whether something meets the thresholds or does not. So the commission, surely the commission isn't saying those old ones come back in, although for some reason it is trying to treat the threshold requirement different from those other requirements, and there is no authority for treating it that way. As I mentioned previously, part of the commission's analysis in these cases was to say that there was no authority that supported our position or what the administrative law judges did in these cases. To the contrary, the first case that I'd like to bring your attention to is Cardwell versus Treasurer. In Cardwell, it was very analogous facts to Mr. Woody's situation. There were a couple of injuries that clearly qualified, and there were some that clearly did not qualify. The employee appealed the denial of benefits from the commission. She argued that her below-threshold disabilities to her knee, body as a whole, left and right wrist should have been included. In that case, the commission had gone through and taken each of those pre-existing disabilities, held it up to the applicable statutory threshold, and said this meets it or this does not meet it. And the appellate court affirmed and said that's the right analysis. Looking at each one of those individually is what you should do, and that's absolutely correct. And the thing about Caldwell, one thing that's interesting to note about Caldwell is that it was actually decided under the old law. So it was decided before August 28, 2005, which was when the workers' compensation law was overhauled, and there was a move in Section 287-800 from liberal construction in favor of compensability to strict construction. If you look at Motton versus Treasure, in that case, the employee's pre-existing injury was 12.5% of the arm at the shoulder level, or the 232-week level. In that case, the commission converted that amount to weeks, which was about 35 weeks, and then compared that with the number of weeks representing a 15% permanent partial disability at the wrist, or the 175-week level, which was 26 weeks. And so in so doing, the commission said, well, this whole 15% disability, that's ambiguous. I don't know what that means, 15% to a major extremity. So I'm just going to convert to weeks, and then we'll see how it compares. And so even though the disability in that case was rated at only 12.5% of the shoulder of this major extremity, the commission went ahead and awarded that person benefits. And we already discussed SHIP, and I've explained, I think, why that isn't applicable to this case and why it isn't applicable generally to body as a whole. I will just say in sum that Mr. Woody does not have any pre-existing disabilities that meet the applicable statutory threshold, and therefore he's not entitled to any compensation from the Second Injury Fund. Thank you.
Thank you. Good judicious use of your time.
Thank you. May it please the court. The James Woody case was transferred to this court by the Western District Appellate Court on its own initiative because of the general interest and importance of the legal issue presented. It is clear, I believe, that the impetus behind that move, which is a rare one, as you know, I think it's been done three times in the last 12 years by the Western District, was that the issue before this court and the issue as found by the appellate court could result in a terrible incongruity if Mr. Woody were denied the benefits from the Second Injury Fund. Indeed, as stated in the majority opinion of the Western District, quote, we would be remiss if we failed to observe that our interpretation is counterintuitive to and inconsistent with the whole purpose and intent of the Second Injury Fund, to provide additional compensation to an injured worker whose injury, when combined with a pre-existing disability or disabilities, results in an even greater hindrance or obstacle to the worker's employment or reemployment, end quote. I might also point out that the majority of the Western District Appellate Court acknowledged that Judge Pfeiffer's dissent set forth an interpretation of Section 220.1 that would permit affirmance of the Labor and Industrial Commission's award to Mr. Woody, a result that is entirely consistent with the purpose of the Second Injury Fund. The interchangeable
opposing counsel says that that can't have any application, at least here, where the type of injuries to the body as a whole are so disparate that there's no synergistic effect of them on each other.
Well, Your Honor, and I disagree with that, first of all, because when you deal with the body as a whole, whether you're talking about a sickness, an illness, or even a death, you can have contributing causes. The idea that the body can be compartmentalized in the way that counsel suggests, I think, simply doesn't match up with reality. Now, admittedly, the workers' compensation system does divide the body up, and we have a chart, of course, that is displayed as the basis for doing some mathematical computation. But the idea that when you're talking about a disability, somehow you can detach these contributing factors. In Mr. Witte's case, they were abundant, as pointed out by the unanimous opinion of the Labor and Industrial Commission, but also as referenced by the Western District Appellate Court. Mr. Witte had a host of infirmities, disabilities, if you will, that contributed, and this is the important part, to his inability to compete as effectively as he could have in the workplace. And that's really at the heart of what workers' compensation law is about. All of these disabilities don't just cripple the individual, but more importantly, in a situation where we're talking about that person's ability to compete in the open labor market, these things that impact upon Mr. Witte's health, I would argue, Your Honor, definitely contribute to cause him a level of disability that he wouldn't have but for the amalgamation of his disabilities. The interchangeable use of the words, quote, disability, end quote, and, quote, disabilities, end quote, in section 287.220.1 clearly, or as Judge Pfeiffer put it, quote, plainly and unambiguously contemplates that a, quote, disability, end quote, may be sustained due to a combined disabilities or, quote, multiple injuries and conditions, end quote. That's important because the fund has attempted to argue here, the treasurer has argued that somehow the use of the singular versus the plural prevents the sort of stacking which SHIP found to be acceptable and which we submit here should be acceptable as a logical extension in the case of body as a whole injuries. In SHIP, as has been discussed, you had disabilities to a wrist and elbow, which the appellate court found could be combined in order to meet the threshold by finding disability at the level of the shoulder.
Do you agree, though, that the decision of the commission is contrary to its prior decision?
I apologize, Your Honor. Do I agree that the decision of the commission in Mr. Witte's case was contrary to
its earlier decisions and the way that it has interpreted the statute?
I understand that argument. I think that what I would suggest is that the reasoning behind the decision was more cogently explained in this case with Mr. Witte. I thought it was a very thorough and comprehensive unanimous decision that the commission put forth. They clearly focused on all of these issues, and I do understand that picking through old decisions, there might seem to be some inconsistency, but I think by and large that what the commission did is to illuminate the reasoning behind the decision that it made.
Ms.
Reeves argues that the interpretation that the statute, the legislature, intended a single disability was the state of the law at the time it undertook its major revisions to the workers' compensation statutes in 2005. And the fact that that was the state of the law, they didn't change it, would tend to be under our rules of construction reinforcement that that's the interpretation that they desired and that they intended.
Well, Your Honor, I think two things. First of all, one of the points that the fund has been making in its argument is that there is, in citing, for example, the Cardwell case, that there has not been a screening, I think, is the way I'm looking at it, of what injuries qualify for second injury fund liability. I think that Cardwell can be explained, for example, by looking to the hindrance and obstacle aspect of an injury. Not just any injury would qualify. It has to be an injury that constitutes a hindrance or obstacle to a substantial gainful activity employment. And in fact, I think in Mr. Witte's case we have that. In Cardwell and some other cases, they didn't have that. And so I think that could explain what on the surface might appear to be an inconsistency. Whether that threshold is met or not may turn in a given case, and it, in some instances, I would say it probably wasn't articulated so in so much detail as it might have been, but it may well turn on whether those injuries that were the subject of the claim constituted a hindrance or obstacle to employment or reemployment. In Mr. Witte's case, I think the finding was clearly that it would constitute such a hindrance or obstacle to his employment, and consequently was properly considered in assessing whether or not he met the threshold. Ship, I think, is indeed the most important case to be considered as this court looks at these issues. Now, obviously, that decision is not binding upon this court.
And it's an isolated decision, isn't that correct?
That is correct.
And what the commission's done in all the cases that we have today is like an extension of SHIP at a minimum.
I think that's a correct characterization, Your Honor. And even though it is not binding upon this court, and I understand that, I think some of the language in SHIP is worth considering. They said, for example, quote, "We believe that just as where there are injuries to multiple parts of the body, it may be appropriate to rate on the body as a whole. Where there are injuries to different parts of an arm, it may often be appropriate to consider the disability of the entire arm." The court said that if you have multiple injuries to a major extremity at various levels, it may be appropriate, depending upon the facts and circumstances, to rate the percentage of disability for the entire major extremity. I think the facts and circumstances in Mr. Witte's case, the case I'm here on, are compelling. Mr. Witte had been a country a fellow, lived in a small town. He was 7 foot tall, 43 years old, had limited formal education, only went to the eighth grade. His primary employment had been as a laborer. His biggest job that he ever held was as a security guard working for the Missouri Department of Corrections. And then he had this long list of disabilities that included diabetes, the left eye, which counsel referred to as lazy eye, that had actually been the subject of several surgical procedures, a right leg injury from a boyhood accident where his foot was stuck in a bicycle spoke and he had 5 fractures there, a gastrointestinal system that acted up to the point that it required, when he was working, a lot of times he had to run to use the restroom on a frequent basis, an injured back, and then this condition of anxiety and depression. All of those were important types of disability which the Labor and Industrial Commission recognized, and I think that in looking at the facts and considering, as was suggested in SHIP, that the court consider the facts and circumstances in each case, those are factors that warrant assessment. Now, the standard of review for this court, as you know, under Section 287495.1, basically is to look at the decision of the Labor and Industrial Commission and to determine, among several elements, the most important of which I think was to determine whether or not there was sufficient competent evidence in the record to warrant the making of the award. Now, there are other elements to determine whether the commission acted without or in excess of its powers, whether the award was procured by fraud, or whether the facts found by the commission do not support the award, but I would respectfully submit that in this instance, as Judge Pfeiffer pointed out, the real focus is whether or not there was sufficient evidence in the record, sufficient competence.
The opponent argues that this isn't a question of application of the facts or determination of the facts as before us, that it is solely a question of law, that we give no deference to the commission, that we are required to determine. Do you agree with that part of her argument?
Well, I actually agree with Judge Pfeiffer. I think that the as he pointed out in his dissent, that the analysis has to go beyond that, first of all, to determine if the Labor and Industrial Commission reached the right decision, i.e., if there was sufficient, competent, and substantial evidence in the record to support that decision, then
don't you have to know what you're applying the evidence to know whether it's sufficient or substantial, that you have to understand what the law is to determine if there's evidence.
Your Honor is of course correct, and I'm not saying there isn't an important legal issue for this court to determine. There certainly is. All I'm saying is, as the dissent said in the appellate court decision, the right, and I should say the entire court agreed with this point, if you interpret the law, as Judge Pfeiffer said, the law should be applied in this instance, then the question is whether or not the Labor and Industrial Commission had substantial evidence to support its decision. And the entire court agreed that if you buy into Judge Pfeiffer's interpretation of the statute, and I think it's a reasonable and sound interpretation, as I've said, then I think it follows then that you would uphold the decision of the Labor and Industrial Commission, because clearly I would say there is substantial evidence to support the finding of disabilities.
The Second Injury Fund's brief argues that body as a whole is a term of art, and that it's in applying body as a whole, the cases of this court interpret the impact of one injury on the body as a whole, as opposed to the cases determining multiple injuries are determined to have an impact on the body as a whole. And so that historically, body as a whole has been the impact of a single injury. What's your response to that argument?
Well, Your Honor, I think probably the clearest example otherwise would be a psychological condition. Mr. Witte had such a condition. The anxiety and depression permeated his ability to be able to compete in the open labor market. Whatever physical injuries he had were enhanced, I would say, embellished by that psychiatric condition. That's just one. You may have many others. Someone with a pulmonary condition might well have physical limitations to the body as a whole that combine with that to make it impossible for him to climb scaffolding or to work at heights or down in a mine or whatever. But I would argue, Your Honor, that there is a lot of overlap in body as a whole injuries, and any workers' compensation practitioner, I think, would readily attest to that. Well, in summary, I am just about out of time. I would simply say, Your Honor, that the purpose of the Second Injury Fund was, as you know, to encourage the hiring and to allow employment of people with disabilities. That purpose would be very dramatically frustrated if, in instances like this, a worker who has a significant pre-existing disability should be prevented from the rewards of the Second Injury Fund. Now, I have a very fat file. This is an $8,500 case. That's what the commission awarded. So, you know, it may seem strange that could affect someone to the degree that I am arguing that it would, but across the board, I think this is a very significant question. And if you assume that this system was set up in order to do justice, then I would maintain, Your Honors, that towards that end, this decision of the Labor and Industrial Commission should be upheld, and the appellate court reversed to that extent. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case we take under submission.
We got a reply.
Oh. Go ahead before you.
I have more to title. I'm sorry.
Yes,
my opposing counsel actually left off where I wanted to start, which is the purpose of the fund. Not only the purpose of the fund, but what was the purpose of these 1993 amendments to the fund? The fund was never designed to be a panacea, and the amendments in 1993 were specifically designed to prevent the fund from paying diminished niggling injuries. Interpreting the fund's liability in the manner advocated by the commission or by my opposing counsel basically undermines in its entirety the 1993 amendments to the fund and has the fund paying the exact type of injuries and disabilities that those amendments were designed to prevent it from paying. If you all do nothing else or your clerks do nothing else, I would really encourage you to look at those 1993 changes and to read the expert medical report about Mr. Witte and the extent of his injuries. And certainly I'm not trying to belittle them, but I'm just saying that somewhere between our version of them and opposing counsel's is the expert report, and it details what his complaints were and how they were treated. There's no testimony here about any sort of synergy between the body as a whole injuries that preexisted the primary injury in this case. The only testimony about any sort of synergy or combination was from the previous injuries and then the primary injury. The doctor, the medical rating doctor in this case, rated all of those body as a whole injuries separately. Now, there are times where I will see where, like I mentioned, there will be a heart condition, but it's so related to someone's diabetes or similar that those will be rated together by the doctor. I don't think it's within the province of this court to disturb that expert's medical opinion, especially insofar as it wasn't any sort of a finding by the ALJ or the commission to that effect. If you look at the dissent...
Can you think of any cases like that that have been decided where a doctor has rated two conditions that go to the body as a whole together?
The one I just mentioned is one that I have actually seen before. And we talked about what we do in that instance. And if there's something like that where it's so inexplicably intertwined, we didn't fight it. I'm not to say that we couldn't, but... or that there might be instances where things are so far-fetched, you know, I have depression and my jaw hurts. Maybe those go together, maybe those don't. Something's wrong with my liver and I have insomnia. I don't know if those go together or not. I think it's possible, if that answers your question. The dissent in this case starts with a flawed premise. It starts with the premise that we here today must defer to what the commission did. But this is, as Judge Breckenridge noted, this is a question of law. This is what statutory threshold applies on these uncontested facts. If you look at the appeals and you look at the history, you look at the appeals that we have today, look at our other pending appeals out there, all of these claimants whose pre-existing conditions were below the thresholds, when they went to the next level, they didn't say you erred in excluding those below threshold injuries. What they argued in every case was you erred in finding that those injuries were so low, that those disability ratings were so low. And the reason that they argued that was because they all knew that they had to meet the thresholds. Thank you.
Thank you. Now the case will be taken under submission.